lives. Ideal camouflage, really, should things become extreme.
Same old DiGioco. Schneider came up and nudged me. Like I told you, always one step ahead of the action.
I shrugged. I've known refugee columns get gunned down just for target practice.
Oh, I'm aware of that. Our friend here was a tactical marine before he met his unfortunate end. Still quite a lot of ingrained reflex left in the cortex, or wherever it is they store that kind of thing.
The boy winked at me.
I'm a businessman, not a technician. I had a software firm in Landfall knock what was left into usable shape. Look.
The child's hand disappeared into his jacket, and the dead man snatched a long barrel blaster from the scabbard across his back. It was very fast. The photoreceptors whirred audibly in their sockets, scanning left to right. Roes Pinoegi grinned broadly, and his hand emerged clutching the remote. A thumb shifted, and the blaster was returned smoothly to its sheath. The arm supporting the boy had not shifted an inch.
"So you see," the boy piped cheerfully, "where pity cannot be mined, less subtle options are always available. But really, I'm optimistic. You'd be surprised how many soldiers still find it difficult to shoot small children, even in these troubled times. Now, enough chatter. Shall we eat?"
Roes Pinoegi had the top floor and penthouse of a rattled warehouse block, not far off touching distance from the tail of the dighead. We left all but two of the militia escort outside in the street, and picked our way through cool gloom to where an industrial elevator stood in one corner. The animated dead man dragged the cage door aside with one hand. Metallic echoes chased around the empty space over our heads.
"I can remember," the boy said as we rose toward the roof, "when all this was stacked with Grade 1 artifacts, crated and tagged for airlift to Landfall. The inventory crews used to work shifts around the clock. The dighead never stopped. You could hear it running day and night under all the other sounds, like a heartbeat."
"Is that what you used to do?" asked Wardani. "Stack artifacts?"
I saw Schneider smile to himself in the gloom.
"When I was younger," said Roes Pinoegi, self-mocking. "But I was involved in a more organizational capacity, shall we say?"
The elevator passed through the roof of the storage area and clanged to a halt in suddenly bright light. Sunlight strained through fabric-curtained windows into a reception lounge, screened from the rest of the floor by amber-painted internal walls. Through the elevator cage I saw kaleidoscopic designs on carpets, dark wood flooring, and long, low sofas arranged around what I took to be a small, internally lit swimming pool. Then, as we stepped out, I saw that the floor recess held not water, but a wide, horizontal video screen, on which a woman appeared to be singing. In two corners of the lounge, the image was duplicated in a more viewable format on two vertical stacks of more reasonable-sized screens. The far wall held a long table, on which someone had laid out enough food and drink for a platoon.
"Make yourselves comfortable," said Roes Pinoegi,
as his corpse guardian bore him away through an arched doorway.
"I'll only be a moment. Food and drink over there. Oh, and volume if you want."
The music on the screen was suddenly audible, instantly recognizable as a Lapinay number, though not her debut cover of the junk salsa hit Open Ground that had caused so much trouble the previous year. This one was slower, merged in with sporadic suborgasmic moaning. On screen, Lapinay hung upside down with her thighs wrapped around the barrel of a spider tank gun and crooned into the camera. Probably a recruiting anthem. Schneider strode to the table and began piling a plate with every type of food the buffet had to offer. I watched the two militiamen take up stations near the elevator, shrugged, and joined them. Tanya Wardani seemed about to follow suit, but then she changed course abruptly and walked to one of the curtained windows instead. One narrow-boned hand went to the patterns woven into the fabric there.
"Told you," Schneider said to me. "If anyone can jack us in on this side of the planet, DiGioco can. He's interfaced with every player in Landfall."
"You mean he was jacked in before the war?" Schneider shook his head.
"Before and during. You heard what he said about the assessor. No way he could pull that kind of gig if he wasn't still jacked into the machine."
If he's jacked into the machine, I asked patiently, eyes still on Wardani, how come he's living in this shithole town?
Maybe he likes it here. This is where he grew up. Anyway, you ever been to Landfall?
Now that's a shithole. Lapinay disappeared from the screen to be replaced by some kind of documentary footage on archaeology. We carried our plates to one of the sofas where Schneider was about to start eating when he saw that I wasn't.
Let's wait, I said softly. It's only polite. He snorted.
What do you think, he's going to poison us? What for? There's no angle in it.
But he left the food alone. The screen shifted again. War footage this time. Merry little flashes of laser fire across a darkened plain somewhere, and the carnival flare of missile impacts. The soundtrack was sanitized, a few explosions muffled by distance and overlaid with dry-voiced commentary, giving innocuous-sounding data. Collateral damage, rebel operations neutralized. Dejoko Roespinoegi emerged from the archway opposite, minus his jacket, and accompanied by two women who looked as if they'd stepped straight out of the software for a virtual brothel. Their muslin-wrapped forms exhibited the same airbrushed lack of blemishes and gravity-defying curves, and their faces held the same absence of expression. Sandwiched between these two confections, the 8-year-old Roespinoegi looked ludicrous.
"Ivana and Kass," he said, gesturing in turn to each woman. "My constant companions. Every boy needs a mother, wouldn't you say? Or two. Now!"
He snapped his fingers, surprisingly loudly, and the two women drifted across to the buffet. He seated himself on an adjacent sofa.
"To business. What exactly can I do for you and your friends, Jan?"
"You're not eating?" I asked him.
"Oh!"
He smiled and gestured at his two companions.
"Well, they are, and I'm really very fond of both of them."
Schneider looked embarrassed.
"No?"
Roespinoegi sighed and reached across to take a pastry from my plate at random. He bit into it.
"There, then. Can we get down to business now, Jan? Please?"
"We want to sell you the shuttle, Dejoko."
Schneider took a huge bite out of a chicken drumstick and talked through it.
"Knock down price."
"Indeed."
"Yeah, call it military surplus. Wu Morrison ISN 70. Very little wear and no previous owner of record."
Roespinoegi smiled.
"I find that hard to believe."
"Check it if you like."
Schneider swallowed his mouthful. "The data cores wiped cleaner than your tax records. 600,000 click range, universal config, hard space, suborbital, submarine. Handles like a whorehouse harpy."
"Yes, I seem to remember the 70s were impressive. Or was it you who told me that, Jan?"
The boy stroked his beardless chin in a gesture that clearly belonged to a previous sleeve.
"Never mind. This knockdown bargain comes armed, I assume."
Schneider nodded, chewing. "Micro-missile turret, nose-mounted, plus evasion systems, full auto-defensive software. Very nice package." I coughed on a pastry. The two women drifted over to the sofa where Roespinoegi sat and arranged themselves in decorative symmetry on either side of him. Neither of them had said a word or made a sound that I could detect since they walked in. The woman on Roespinoegi's left began to feed him from her plate. He leaned back against her and eyed me speculatively while he chewed on what she gave him.
"All right,"
he said finally.
"$6 million.
"U.N.?"
asked Schneider, and Roespinoegi laughed out loud.
"Saft! $6 million saft!"
The standard archaeological fine token, created back when the sanctioned government was still little more than a global claims administrator, and now an unpopular global currency whose performance against the Latimer franc it had replaced was reminiscent of a swamp panther trying to climb a frick-free treated dock ramp. There were currently about 230 saft to the protectorate U.N. dollar. Schneider was aghast, his haggler's soul outraged.
"You cannot be serious, Dejoko. Even $6 million U.N. is only about half what it's worth. It's a Wu Morrison, man. Does it have cryocaps?"
No.
"So what the fuck use is it to me, Jan?
Roespinowegi asked without heat. He glanced sideways at the woman on his right, and she passed him a wine glass without a word.
Look, at this precise moment, the only use anyone outside the military has for a space rig is as a means of lifting out of here, beating the blockade and getting back to Latimer. That 600,000-kilometer range can be modified by someone who knows what they're doing, and the Womb Morrisons have goodish guidance systems. I know. But at the speed you'll get out of an ISN-70, especially backyard customized, it's still the best part of 3 decades back to Latimer. You need cryo-capsules for that.
He held up a hand to forestall Schneider's protest.
And I don't know anyone who can get cryo-caps. Not for cunt nor credit. The Landfall Cartel know what they're about, Jan. And they've got it all welded shut. No one gets out of here alive, not until the war's over. That's the deal.
You can always sell to the Kempists, I said. They're pretty desperate for the hardware. They'll pay. Roespinowegi nodded.
Yes, Mr. Kovach, they will pay. And they'll pay in Saft, because it's all they've got. Your friends in the Wedge have seen to that.
Not my friends. I'm just wearing this.
Rather well, though.
I shrugged. What about 10? Schneider said hopefully. Kemp's paying 5 times that for reconditioned suborbitals. Roespinowegi sighed.
Yes, and in the meantime I have to hide it somewhere and pay off anyone who sees it. It's not a dune scooter, you know. Then I have to make contact with the Kempists, which, as you may be aware, carries a mandatory erasure penalty these days. I have to arrange a covert meeting, oh, and with armed backup in case these toy revolutionaries decide to requisition my merchandise instead of paying up, which they often do if you don't come heavy. Look at the logistics, Jan. I'm doing you a favor just taking it off your hands. Who else we are going to go to?
8. 6 is fine, I cut in swiftly, and we appreciate the favor. But how about you sweeten our end with a ride into Landfall and then a little free information? Just to show we're all friends. The boy's gaze sharpened, and he glanced toward Tanya Wardani.
Free information, huh?
He raised his eyebrows, twice in quick succession, clownishly.
Of course there's really no such thing, you know. But just to show we're all friends. What do you want to know?
Landfall, I said. Outside the cartel. Who are the Razorfish? I'm talking about second-rank corporates, maybe even third-rank. Who's tomorrow's shiny new dream at the moment? Roespinowegi sipped meditatively at his wine.
Razorfish. I don't believe we have any of those on Sanction 4. Or Latimer, come to that.
I'm from Harlan's world.
Oh, really? Not a Quellist, I assume.
He gestured at the Wedge uniform.
Given your current political alignment, I mean.
You don't want to oversimplify Quellism. Kemp keeps quoting her, but like most people, he's selective.
Well, I really wouldn't know.
Roespinowegi put up one hand to block the next piece of food his concubine was readying for him.
But your Razorfish, I'd see you've got 6 at most. Late arrivals, most of them. Latimer-based. The Interstellars blocked out most of the local competition until about 20 years ago. And now, of course, they've got the cartel and the government in their pocket. There's not much more than scraps for everybody else. Most of the third rank are getting ready to go home. They can't really afford the war.
He stroked at his imagined beard.
Second rank, well, Sathakarn U Associates, maybe, PKN, the Mandrake Corporation. They're all pretty carnivorous. Might be a couple more I can dig out for you. Are you planning to approach these people with something?
I nodded. Indirectly?
Yes, well, some free advice to go with your free information, then. Feed it to them on a long stick.
Roespinowegi raised his glass toward me, and then drained it. He smiled affably.
Because if you don't, they'll take your hand off at the shoulder.
Chapter 7. Like a lot of cities that owe their existence to a spaceport, Landfall had no real center. Instead, it sprawled haphazardly across a broad, semi-desert plain in the southern hemisphere, where the original colony barges had touched down a century ago. Each corporation holding stock in the venture had simply built its own landing field somewhere on the plain and surrounded it with a ring of ancillary structures. In time, these rings spread outward, met each other, and eventually merged into a warren of eccentric conurbation with only the vaguest of overall planning to link it all together. Secondary investors moved in, renting or buying space from the primaries, and carving themselves niches in both the market and the rapidly burgeoning metropolis. Meanwhile, other cities arose elsewhere on the globe, but the export quarantine clause in the charter ensured that all the wealth generated by Sanction 4's archaeological industries had at some point to pass through landfall, gorged on an unrestricted diet of artifact export, land allocation, and dig licensing. The former spaceport had swelled to monstrous proportions. It now covered 2/3 of the plain, and with 12 million inhabitants, was home to almost 30% of what was left of Sanction 4's total population. It was a pit. I walked with Schneider through badly kept streets full of urban detritus and reddish desert sand. The air was hot and dry, and the shade cast by the blocks on either side provided little respite from the high-angled rays of the sun. I could feel sweat beading on my face and soaking the hair at the back of my neck. In windows and mirror-shielded frontages along the way, our black-uniformed reflections kept pace. I was almost glad of the company. There was no one else out in the midday heat, and the shimmering stillness of it was uncanny. The sand crunched audibly underfoot. The place we were looking for wasn't hard to find. It stuck up at the edge of the district like a burnished bronze conning tower, double the height of the surrounding blocks and utterly featureless from the outside. Like much of the architecture in landfall, it was mirror-surfaced, and the reflected sun made its edges difficult to look at directly. It wasn't the tallest tower in landfall, but the structure had a raw power to it that throbbed across the surrounding urban sprawl and spoke volumes about its designers. Testing the human frame to destruction. The phrase flopped out of my memory like a corpse from a closet.
"How close you want to get?" Schneider asked nervously.
"A bit closer." The Kumalo sleeve, like all Carrera's wedge custom, had a SAT data locational display wired in as standard and reckoned to be quite user-friendly when not fucked up by the webs of jamming and counter-jamming that currently swathed most of Sanction 4. Blinked up to focus now, it gave me a mesh of streets and city blocks covering my whole left field of vision. Two tagged dots pulsed minutely on a thoroughfare. I over-cued the tight-lock fractionally, and the view dizzied up until I was looking at the top of my own head from block-top height. Shit.
What?
Beside me, Schneider had tensed up in what he obviously imagined was a stance of ninja combat readiness. Behind his sunglasses, he looked comically worried. Testing. Forget it. I scaled back up until the tower re-emerged on the edge of the display. A shortest possible route lit up obligingly in yellow, threading us to the building through a pair of intersections. This way. Testing the human frame to destruction is only one of the cutting-edge lines. A couple of minutes down the yellow line, one of the streets gave onto a narrow suspension bridge over a dry canal. The bridge sloped upward slightly along its 20-meter length to meet a raised concrete flange on the far side. Two other bridges paralleled the crossing 100 meters down on either side, also sloping upward. The floor of the canal bore a scattering of the debris any urban area will breed. Discarded domestic devices, spilling circuitry from cracked casings, emptied food packages, and sun-bleached knots of cloth that reminded me of machine-gun bodies. Over it all, and on the other side of this dumping ground, the tower waited. Testing the human... Schneider hovered on the threshold of the bridge.
"You're going across?"
"Yeah, and so are you. We're partners, remember?" I shoved him lightly in the small of the back, and followed up so close he'd have to go on. There was a slightly hysterical good humor brewing in me as the envoy conditioning strove to fend off the unsubtle doses of combat prep hormones my sleeve sensed were required.
"I just don't think this is..."
"If anything goes wrong, you can blame me." I nudged him again. "Now come on."
"If anything goes wrong, we'll be dead."
he muttered morosely. Yeah, at least. We crossed, Schneider holding onto the rails as if the bridge were swaying in a high wind. The flange on the other side turned out to be the edge of a featureless 50-meter access plaza. We stood 2 meters in, looking up at the impassive face of the tower. Whether intentionally or not, whoever had built the concrete apron around the building's base had created a perfect killing field. There was no cover in any direction, and the only retreat was back along the slim, exposed bridge, or a bone-shattering jump into the empty canal. "Open ground all around," Schneider sang under his breath, picking up on the cadence and lyrics of the Kempist revolutionary hymn of the same name. I couldn't blame him. I'd caught myself humming the fucking thing a couple of times since we'd gotten into the unjammed airspace around the city. The Lapinay version was everywhere, close enough to the Kempist original to activate recall from last year. Back then you could hear the original playing on the Rebels' propaganda channels whenever and wherever the government jamming went down, telling the apparently edifying story of a doomed platoon of volunteers holding a position against overwhelming odds for love of Joshua Kemp and his revolution. The anthem was sung against a catchy junk salsa backdrop that tended to stick in your head. Most of my men in the Northern Rim Assault Force could sing it by heart, and often did, to the fury of cartel political officers, who were mostly too scared of the wedge uniforms to make something of it. In fact, the melody had proven so virulently mimetic that even the most solidly pro-corporate citizens were unable to resist absent-mindedly humming it. This, plus a network of cartel informers working on a commission-only basis, was enough to ensure that penal facilities all over Sanction 4 were soon overflowing with musically inclined political offenders. In view of the strain this put on policing, an expensive consulting team was called in and rapidly came up with a new set of sanitized lyrics to fit the original melody. Lapinay, a construct vocalist, was designed and launched to front the replacement song, which told the story of a young boy, orphaned in a Kempist sneak raid, but then adopted by a kindly corporate block and brought up to realize his full potential as a top-level planetary executive. As a ballad, it lacked the romantic blood-and-glory elements of the original, but since certain of the Kempist lyrics had been mirrored with malice aforethought, people generally lost track of which song was which and just sang a mangled hybrid of both, sewn together with much salsa-based humming. Any revolutionary sentiments got thoroughly scrambled in the process. The consulting team got a bonus, plus spin-off royalties from Lapinay, who was currently being plugged on all state channels. An album was in the offing. Schneider stopped his humming.
Think they've got it covered?
Reckon so. I nodded toward the base of the tower, where burnished doors, fully 5 meters high, apparently gave access. The massive portal was flanked by 2 plinths, on which stood examples of abstract art, each worthy of the title Eggs Collide in Symmetry, or... I racked up the Nurachem to be sure. Overkill hardware semi-deployed. Schneider followed my gaze.
Sentries?
I nodded. 2 slug autocannon nests and at least 4 separate beam weapons that I can see from here. Very tastefully done, too. You'd barely notice them in among all that sculpture. In a way, it was a good sign. In the 2 weeks we'd spent in Landfall so far, I hadn't seen much sign of the war beyond a slightly higher uniform count on the streets in the evenings and the occasional cyst of a rapid response turret on some of the taller buildings. Most of the time you could have been forgiven for thinking it was all happening on another planet. But if Joshua Kemp did finally manage to fight his way through to the capital, the Mandrake Corporation at least looked to be ready for him. Testing the human frame to destruction is only one of the cutting-edge lines central to the Mandrake Corporation's current research program. Maximum utility for all resources is our ultimate goal. Mandrake had only acquired the site a decade ago. That they had built with armed insurrection in mind showed strategic thinking way in advance of any of the other corporate players at this particular table. Their corporate logo was a chopped strand of DNA afloat on a background of circuitry. Their publicity material was just the right side of shrill and its aggressive, more-for-your-investment-dollar, new-kid-on-the-block pitch, and their fortunes had risen sharply with the war. Good enough.
Think they're looking at us now?
I shrugged. Always someone looking at you. Fact of life. Question is whether they noticed us. Schneider pulled an exasperated face.
Think they noticed us then?
I doubt it. The automated systems won't be tuned for it. War is too far off for emergency default settings. These are friendly uniforms, and curfew is until 10. We're nothing out of the ordinary.
Yet.
Yet, I agreed, turning away. So let's go and get noticed. We headed back across the bridge. You don't look like artists, said the promoter, as he punched in the last of our encoding sequence. Out of uniform and into nondescript civilian clothing, bought that morning, we'd been calibrated the moment we walked in the door, and, by the look of it, found lacking. We're security, I told him pleasantly. She's the artist. His gaze flipped across the table to where Tanya Wardani sat behind winged black sun lenses and a clamp-mouthed grimace. She had started to fill out a little in the last couple of weeks, but beneath the long black coat it didn't show, and her face was still mostly bone. The promoter grunted, apparently satisfied with what he saw.
Well,
he maximized a traffic display and studied it for a moment.
I have to tell you, whatever it is you're selling, you're up against a lot of state-sponsored competition.
What, like Lapinay?
The derision in Schneider's voice would have been apparent across interstellar distances. The promoter smoothed back his imitation military goatee, sat back in his chair, and stuck one fake combat-booted foot on the desk edge. At the base of his shaven skull, three or four battlefield quick-plant software tags stuck out from their sockets, too shiny to be anything but designer copies.
"Don't laugh at the majors, friend," he said easily. "I had even a 2% share in the Lapinay deal, I'd be living in Latimer City by now. I'm telling you, the best way to defuse wartime art is to buy it up. Corporates know that. They've got the machinery to sell it at volume and the clout to censor the competition out of existence. Now,"
he tapped the display where our upload sat like a tiny purple torpedo waiting to be fired,
"whatever it is you've got there, better be pretty fucking hot if you expect it to swim against that current."
"Are you this positive with all your clients?" I asked him. He smiled bleakly.
"I'm a realist. You pay me, I'll shunt it. Got the best anti-screening intrusion software in Landfall to get it there in one piece. Just like the sign says, we get you noticed. But don't expect me to massage your ego, too, because that isn't part of the service. Where you want this squirted, there's too much going on to be optimistic about your chances."
At our backs, a pair of windows were open onto the noise of the street three floors below. The air outside had cooled with the onset of evening, but the atmosphere in the promoter's office still tasted stale. Tanya Wardani shifted impatiently.
"It's a niche thing," she rasped. "Can we get on with this?"
"Sure."
The promoter glanced once more at the credit screen and the payment that floated there in hard green digits.
"Better fasten your launch belts. This is going to cost you at speed."
He hit the switch. There was a brief ripple across the display, and the purple torpedo vanished. I caught a glimpse of it represented on a series of helix-based transmission visuals, and then it faded, swallowed behind the wall of corporate data security systems, and presumably beyond the tracking capacity of the promoter's much-vaunted software. The green digit counters whirled into frantic, blurred eights.
"Told you," said the promoter, shaking his head judiciously. "High-line screening systems like that would have cost them a year's profits just for the installation. And cutting the high-line costs, my friends."
Evidently. I watched our credit decay like an unprotected antimatter core, and quelled a sudden desire to remove the promoter's throat with my bare hands. It wasn't really the money. We had plenty of that. 6 million saft might have been a poor price for a Wu Morrison shuttle, but it was going to be enough for us to live like kings for the duration of our stay in Landfall. It wasn't the money. It was the designer fashion war gear and the drawled theories on what to do with wartime art. The fake, seen it, been it world weariness, while on the other side of the equator, men and women blew each other apart in the name of minor adjustments to the system,
that kept Landfall fed.
That's it.
The promoter played a brisk drum roll across his console with both hands.
Gone home, near as I can tell. Time for you boys and girls to do the same.
Near as you can tell, said Schneider. What the fuck is that?
He got the bleak smile again.
Hey, read your contract. To the best of our ability, we deliver. And that's to the best of anyone else's ability on Sanction 4. You bought state-of-the-art. You didn't buy any guarantees.
He ejected our eviscerated credit chip from the machine and tossed it onto the table in front of Tanya Wardani, who pocketed it, deadpan.
So how long do we wait?
She asked through a yawn.
What am I, clairvoyant?
The promoter sighed.
Could be quick, like a couple of days. Could be a month or more. All depends on the demo, and I didn't see that. I'm just the mailman. Could be never. Go home. I'll mail you.
We left, seen out with the same studied disinterest that we'd been received and processed with. Outside, we went left in the evening gloom, crossed the street, and found a terrace cafe about 20 meters up from the promoter's garish third-floor display hollow. This close to curfew, it was almost deserted. We dumped our bags under a table and ordered short coffees.
How long?
Wardani asked again. 30 minutes, I shrugged. Depends on their AI. 45 the outside. I still hadn't finished my coffee when they came. The cruiser was an unobtrusive brown utility vehicle, ostensibly bulky and underpowered, but to a tutored eye, very obviously armored. It slunk around a corner 100 meters up the street at ground level and crawled down toward the promoter's building. Here we go, I murmured, wisps of Kamala Nurikim flickering into life up and down my body. Stay here, both of you. I stood up unhurriedly and drifted across the street, hands in pockets, head cocked at a rubbernecker's angle. Ahead of me, the cruiser floated to a curb-hugging halt outside the promoter's door, and a side hatch hinged up. I watched as 5 coverall-clad figures climbed out and then vanished into the building with a telltale economy of motion. The hatch folded back down. I picked up speed fractionally as I made my way among the hurrying last-minute shoppers on the pavement, and my left hand closed around the thing in my pocket. The cruiser's windshield was solid-looking and almost opaque. Behind it, my neurochem-aided vision could just distinguish 2 figures in the seats and the hint of another body bulking behind them, braced upright to peer out. I glanced sideways at a shop frontage, closing the last of the gap up to the front of the cruiser. And time. Less than 0.5 meter, and my left hand came out of its pocket. I slammed the flat disc of the termite grenade hard against the windshield and stepped immediately aside and passed.
Crack!
With termite grenades, you've got to get out of the way quickly. The new ones are designed to deliver all their shrapnel and better than 95% of their force to the contact face, but the 5% that comes out on the opposite side will still make a mess of you if you stand in the way. The cruiser shuddered from end to end. Contained within the armored body, the sound of the explosion was reduced to a muffled crump. I ducked in through the door to the promoter's building and went up the stairs at a run. At the first floor landing, I reached for the interface guns, the bio-alloy plates sewn beneath the palms of my hands, already flexing, yearning. They'd posted a single sentry on the third floor landing, but they weren't expecting trouble from behind. I shot him through the back of the head as I came up the last flight of stairs, splash of blood and paler tissue and clots across the wall in front of him, made the landing before he'd hit the ground, and then erupted around the corner of the promoter's office door. The echo of the first shot, like the first sip of whiskey, burning. Splinters of vision. The promoter tries to rise from his seat where 2 of them have him pinned and tilted back. 1 arm thrashes free and points in my direction.
That's her.
The goon nearest the door, turning. Cut him down. 3-shot burst, left-handed. Blood splatters the air. I twist, Nurikim hyperswift, to avoid it. The squad leader, recognizable somehow, taller, more presence, something, yelling, "What the fuck?" Body shots, chest and weapon arm. Get that firing hand wrecked. The right-hand Kalashnikov spurts flame and soft-cored anti-personnel slugs. Two left, trying to shrug themselves free of the half-pinioned, flailing promoter, to clear weapons that... Both hands now. Head, body, anywhere. The Kalashnikovs bark like excited dogs. Bodies jerking, tumbling, and done. Silence slammed down in the tiny office. The promoter cowered under the body of one of his slain captors. Somewhere, something sparked and shorted out in the console, damage from one of my slugs that had gone wide or through. I could hear voices out on the landing. I knelt beside the wreckage of the lead goon's corpse and set down the smart guns. Beneath my jacket, I tugged the vibro-knife from its sheath in the small of my back and activated the motor. With my free hand, I pressed down hard on the dead man's spine and started cutting.
"Oh, fuck, man."
The promoter gagged and threw up across his console.
"Fuck, fuck."
I looked up at him. "Shut up. This isn't easy." He ducked down again. After a couple of false starts, the vibro-knife took and sliced down through the spinal column a few vertebrae below the point where it met the base of the skull. I steadied the skull against the floor with one knee, then pressed down again and started a new incision. The knife slipped and slithered again on the curve of the bone. Shit! The voices out on the landing were growing in number, and it seemed creeping closer. I stopped what I was doing, picked up one of the Kalashnikovs left-handed, and fired abrasive shots out the doorway into the wall opposite. The voices departed in a stampede of feet on stairs. Back to the knife. I managed to get the point lodged, cut through the bone, and then used the blade to lever the severed section of spine up out of the surrounding flesh and muscle. Messy, but there wasn't a lot of time. I stuffed the severed bone into a pocket, wiped my hands on a clean portion of the dead man's tunic, and sheathed the knife. Then I picked up the smart guns and went cautiously to the door. Quiet. As I was leaving, I glanced back at the promoter. He was staring at me as if I just sprouted a reef demon's fangs. "Go home," I told him. "They'll be back, near as I can tell." I made it down the three flights of stairs without meeting anyone, though I could feel eyes peering from other doors on the landings I passed. Outside, I scanned the street in both directions, stowed the Kalashnikovs, and slipped away, past the hot, smoldering carapace of the bombed-out cruiser. The pavement was empty for 50 meters in both directions, and the frontages on either side of the wreck had all cranked down their security blinds. A crowd was gathering on the other side of the street, but no one seemed to know what exactly to do. A few passerby who noticed me looked hurriedly away as I passed. Chapter 8. Nobody said much on the way to the hotel. We did most of it on foot, doubling back through covered ways and malls to blind any satellite eyes the Mandrake Corporation might have access to. Breathless work, weighed down with the carry-all bags. 20 minutes of this found us under the broad eaves of a refrigerated storage facility, where I waved a transport pager at the sky, and eventually succeeded in flagging down a cab. We climbed in without leaving the cover of the eaves and sank back into the seats without a word.
"It is my duty to inform you," the machine told us prissily, "that in 17 minutes you will be in breach of curfew."
"Better get us home quick, then," I said, and gave it the address.
"Estimated trajectory time, 9 minutes. Please insert payment."
I nodded at Schneider, who produced an unused credit chip, and fed it to the slot. The cab chittered, and we lifted smoothly into a night sky almost devoid of traffic before sliding off westward. I rolled my head sideways on the back of the seat and watched the lights of the city pass beneath us for a while, mentally backtracking to see how well we'd covered ourselves. When I rolled my head back again, I caught Tanya Wardani staring straight at me. She didn't look away. I went back to watching the lights until we started to fall back toward them. The hotel was well chosen, the cheapest of a row built under a commercial freight overpass, and used almost exclusively by prostitutes and wireheads. The desk clerk was sleeved in a cheap synthetic sleeve, whose silico flesh was showing signs of wear around the knuckles and had a very obvious reupholstering graft halfway up the right arm. The desk was heavily stained in a number of places, and nubbed every 10 centimeters along its outer edge with shield generators. In the corners of the dimly lit lobby, empty-faced women and boys flickered about wanly, like flames almost out. The desk clerk's logo-scribbled eyes passed over us like a damp cloth. 10 saft an hour, 50 deposit up front. Shower and screen access is another 50.
We want it for the night, Schneider told him. Curfew just came down, in case you hadn't noticed.
The clerk stayed expressionless, but then maybe that was the sleeve. Synthetta had been known to skimp on the smaller facial nerve muscle interfaces.
Then that'll be 80 saft plus 50 deposit. Shower and screen 50 extra.
No discount for long-stay guests? His eyes switched to me, and one hand disappeared below the counter. I felt the Nurachem surge, still jumpy after the firefight.
You want the room or not?
We want it,
said Schneider with a warning glance at me.
You got a chip reader?
That's 10% extra.
He seemed to search his memory for something.
Handling surcharge.
Fine. The clerk propped himself to his feet, disappointed, and went to fetch the reader from a room and back.
Cash,
murmured Wardani.
We should have thought of that.
Schneider shrugged.
Can't think of everything. When was the last time you paid for something without a chip?
She shook her head. I thought back briefly to a time 3 decades gone in a place light-years distance, where for a while I'd used tactile currency instead of credit. I'd even gotten used to the quaint plastified notes with their ornate designs and holographic panels. But that was on Earth, and Earth is a place straight out of a pre-colonial period Xperia flick. For a while there, I'd even thought I was in love, and motivated by love and hate in about equal proportions. I'd done some stupid things. A part of me had died on Earth. Another planet, another sleeve. I shook an unfairly well-remembered face from my mind and looked around, seeking to embed myself back in the present. Garishly painted faces looked back from the shadows, then away. Thoughts for a brothel lobby. Ye gods. The desk clerk came back, read one of Schneider's chips, and banged a scarred plastic keycard on the counter.
Through the back and down the stairs. 4th level. I've activated the shower and screen till curfew break. You want any bit longer, you'll need to come up and pay again.
The silico-flesh face flexed in what was probably supposed to be a grin. He shouldn't have bothered.
Rooms are all soundproofed. Do what you like.
The corridor and steel-frame stairwell were, if anything, worse lit than the lobby. In places, the aluminum tiles were peeling off the walls and ceiling. Elsewhere, they had just gone out. The stair rail was painted luminous, but that too was fading, coming off microns at a time with every hand that gripped and slid along the metal. We passed a scattering of whores on the stairs, most with customers in tow. Little bubbles of fake hilarity floated around them, tinkling. Business seemed to be brisk. I spotted a couple of uniforms among the clientele, and what looked like a cartel political officer leaned on the 2nd-level landing rail, smoking pensively. No one gave us a second glance. The room was long and low-ceilinged, with a quick-mold resin cornice and pillar effect epoxied onto the raw concrete walls, the whole then painted in violent primary red. About halfway down, 2 bedshelves jutted out from opposing walls with 0.5 meter of space between their adjacent sides. The 2nd bed had plastic chains molded into the 4 corners of the shelf. At the far end of the room stood a self-contained shower stall, wide enough to take 3 bodies at a time, should the occasion so require. Opposite each bed was a wide screen with a menu display glowing on a pale pink background. I looked around, puffed a single breath out into blood-warm air, and then stooped to the carryall at my feet.
Make sure that door's secured.
I pulled the sweeper unit out of the bag and waved it around the room. 3 bugs showed up in the ceiling, one above each bed and 1 in the shower. Very imaginative. Schneider snapped a wedge-standard limpet neutralizer onto the ceiling next to each one.
They'd get into the bug's memories, pull out whatever had been stored there over the last couple of hours, and then recycle it endlessly. The better models will even scan the content and then generate plausible improvised scenes from stock, but I didn't think that was going to be necessary here. The desk clerk had not given the impression that he was fronting a high-security operation.
"Where do you want this stuff?"
Schneider asked Wardani, unpacking one of the other carry-alls onto the first bed shelf.
"Right there is fine,"
she said.
"Here, I'll do it. It's complicated."
Schneider raised an eyebrow. "Right, fine. I'll just watch." Complicated or not, it took the archaeologue only about 10 minutes to assemble her equipment. When she was done, she took a pair of modified EV goggles from the flaccid skin of the empty carryall and settled them over her head. She turned to me.
"You want to give me that?"
I reached into my jacket and produced the segment of spine. There were still fresh streaks of gore clinging to the tiny bumps and crannies of the bone, but she took it without apparent revulsion and dumped it onto the top of the artifact scrubber she'd just finished snapping together. A pale violet light sprang up under the glass hood. Schneider and I watched fascinated as she jacked the goggles into one side of the machine, picked up the connected handset, and settled cross-legged to work. From within the machine came tiny crackling sounds.
"Working all right?" I asked.
She grunted.
"How long is this going to take?"
"Longer if you keep asking me stupid questions,"
she said without looking away from what she was doing.
"Don't you have anything else to do?"
Out of the corner of my eye, I caught Schneider grinning. By the time we'd put together the other machine, Wardani was almost done. I peered over her shoulder into the purple glow and saw what remained of the spinal segment. Most of it was gone, and the final pieces of vertebrae were being eaten away from the tiny metal cylinder of the cortical stack. I was fixated. It wasn't the first time I'd seen a cortical stack removed from a dead spine, but it had to be among the most elegant versions of the operation I'd ever witnessed. The bone retreated, vanishing one minute increment at a time, as Tanya Wardani cut it away with her tools, and the stack casing emerged scrubbed clean of surrounding tissue and shiny as new tin.
"I do know what I'm doing, Kovach,"
Wardani said, voice slow and absent with concentration.
"Compared to scrubbing the accretion off Martian circuit boards, this is like sandblasting."
"I don't doubt it. I was just admiring your handiwork." She did look up then, sharply, pushing the goggles up on her forehead to see if I was laughing at her. When she saw I wasn't, she lowered the goggles again, made a couple of adjustments to something on the handset, then sat back. The violet light went out.
"It's done."
She reached into the machine and removed the stack, holding it between thumb and forefinger.
"Incidentally, this isn't great equipment. In fact, it's the sort of thing scratchers buy for their thesis work. The sensors are pretty crude. I'm going to need a lot better than this up on the rim."
"Don't worry."
I took the cortical stack from her and turned to the machine on the other bed. "If this works out, they'll build your gear to custom order. Now listen carefully, both of you. There may well be a virtual environment tracer built into the stack. A lot of corporate samurai are wired that way. This one may not be, but we're going to assume he is. That means we've got about a minute of safe access before the trace powers up and kicks in. So when that counter hits 50 seconds, you shut everything down. This is just a casualty ID&A, but cranked up, we'll still get a ratio of about 35-1 real time. Little over half an hour, but that ought to be enough."
"What are you going to do to him?"
This was Wardani, looking unhappy.
I reached for the skull cap. "Nothing. There isn't time. I'm just going to talk to him."
"Talk?"
There was a strange light in her eyes.
"Sometimes," I told her, "that's all it takes." It was a rough ride in. Casualty identification and assessment is a relatively new tool in military accounting. We didn't have it at Inanen. The prototype systems didn't appear until after I'd bailed out of the Corps. And even then, it was decades before anyone outside Protectorate Elite Forces could afford it. The cheaper models came out about 15 years ago, much to the delight of military auditors everywhere.
though of course they weren't ever the ones who had to ride the system. ID&A is a job usually done by battlefield medics trying to pull the dead and wounded out, often under fire. Under those circumstances, smooth format transition tends to be seen as a bit of a luxury, and the set we'd liberated from the hospital shuttle was definitely a no-frills model. I closed my eyes in the concrete-walled room, and the induction kicked me in the back of the head like a tetrameth rush. For a couple of seconds, I sank dizzyingly through an ocean of static, and then that snapped out, replaced by a boundless field of wheat that stood unnaturally still under a late afternoon sun. Something hit me hard in the soles of the feet, jolting upward, and I was standing on a long wooden porch looking out over the field. Behind me was the house the porch belonged to, a single-story wood frame place, apparently old but too perfectly finished for anything that had genuinely aged. The boards all met with geometric precision, and there were no flaws or cracks anywhere that I could see. It looked like something an AI with no humanity interface protocols would dream up from image stock, and that's probably exactly what it was. 30 minutes, I reminded myself. Time to identify and assess. It's in the nature of modern warfare that there often isn't very much left of dead soldiers, and that can make life difficult for the auditors. Certain soldiers will always be worth resleeving. Experienced officers are a valuable resource, and a grunt at any level may have vital specialist skills or knowledge. The problem lies in identifying these soldiers rapidly and separating them out from the grunts who aren't worth the cost of a new sleeve. How, in the screaming chaos of a war zone, are you going to do this? Barcoding burns off with the skin. Dog tags melt or get inconveniently shredded by shrapnel. DNA scanning is sometimes an option, but it's chemically complicated, hard to administer on a battlefield, and some of the nastier chemical weapons will fuck up the results completely. Worse still, none of this will tell you if the slain soldier is still a psychologically viable unit for resleeving. How you die? Fast, slow, alone, with friends, in agony, or numb, is bound to affect the level of trauma you suffer. The level of trauma affects your combat viability. So too does your resleeving history. Too many new sleeves too fast leads to repeat resleeve syndrome, which I'd seen the year before in a once-too-often-retrieved wedge demolition sergeant. They downloaded him, for the 9th time since the war began, into a clone-fresh 20-year-old sleeve, and he sat in it like an infant in its own shit, screaming and weeping incoherently in between bouts of introspection in which he examined his own fingers as if they were toys he didn't want anymore. Oops. The point is, there's no way to learn these facts with any degree of certainty from the broken and charred remnants the medics are often faced with. Fortunately for the accountants, though, cortical stack technology makes it possible not only to identify and tag individual casualties, but also to find out if they have gone irretrievably screaming insane. Snugged inside the spinal column, just below the skull, the mind's black box is about as safe as it's possible to make it. The surrounding bone in itself is remarkably resistant to damage, and just in case good old evolutionary engineering isn't up to the job, the materials used to make cortical stacks are among the hardest artificial substances known to man. You can sandblast a stack clean without worrying about damaging it, jack it into a virtual environment generator by hand, and then just dive in after your subject. The equipment to do all this will fit into a large carry-all. I went to the perfect wooden door. Chiseled into a copper plate on the boards beside it was an 8-digit serial number and a name. Deng Zhao Jun. I turned the handle. The door swung inward noiselessly, and I walked through into a clinically tidy space dominated by a long wooden table. A pair of mustard-cushioned armchairs stood off to one side, facing a grate in which a small fire crackled. At the back of the room, doors appeared to lead off to a kitchen and a bedroom. He was seated at the table, head in his hands. Apparently he hadn't heard the door open. The set would have brought him online a few seconds before it let me in, so he'd probably had a couple of minutes to get over the initial shock of arrival and realize where he was. Now he just had to deal with it. I coughed gently. "Good evening, Deng." He looked up and dropped his hands back to the table when he saw me. The words came out of him in a rush.
"We were set up, man. It was a fucking setup.
Someone was waiting for us. You can tell Hand his security's fucked. They must...
His voice dried up, and his eyes widened as he recognized me. Yes. He jerked to his feet.
Who the fuck are you?
That's not really important. Look. But it was too late. He was up and coming for me around the table, eyes slitted with fury. I stepped back. Look, there's no point... He closed the gap and lashed out. Knee-height kick and mid-level punch. I blocked the kick, locked up the punching arm, and dumped him on the floor. He tried another kick as he landed, and I had to dodge back out of reach to avoid getting hit in the face. Then he slithered to his feet and came at me again. This time I stepped in to meet him, deflecting his attacks with wing blocks and butterfly kicks and using knees and elbows to take him down. He grunted gut deep with the blows and hit the floor for the second time, one arm folded beneath his body. I went down after him, landed on his back, and dragged the available wrist up, locking out the arm until it creaked.
Right, that's enough. You are in a fucking virtuality.
I got my breath back and lowered my voice. Plus, any more shit out of you and I'll break this arm. Got it? He nodded as best he could with his face pressed into the floorboards. All right. I lessened the pressure on the arm a fraction. Now I'm going to let you up, and we're going to do this in a civilized fashion. I want to ask you some questions, Dang. You don't have to answer them if you don't want to, but it'll be in your best interests. So just hear me out. I got up and stepped away from him. After a moment, he climbed to his feet and limped back to his chair, massaging his arm. I sat down at the other end of the table. You wired for Virtual Trace? He shook his head. Yeah, well, you'd probably say that even if you were. It isn't going to help. We're running a mirror code scrambler. Now, I want to know who your controller is. He stared at me.
Why should I tell you a fucking thing?
Because if you do, I'll turn your cortical stack back over to Mandrake, and they'll probably re-sleeve you. I leaned forward in the chair. That's a one-time special offer, Dang. Grab it while it lasts.
If you kill me, Mandrake'll...
No. I shook my head. Get a sense of reality about this. You're what, a security operations manager? Tactical deployment exec? Mandrake can get a dozen like you from stock. There are platoon non-coms on the government reserve who'd give blowjobs for the chance to duck out of the fighting. Any one of them could do your job. And besides, the men and women you work for would sell their own children into a brothel if it meant getting their hands on what I showed them tonight. And alongside that, my friend, you don't matter. Silence. He sat looking at me, hating. I deployed one from the manual. They might like to do a retribution number on general principles, of course. Make it known that their operatives are not to be touched without dire consequences. Most hardline outfits like to whistle that tune, and I don't suppose Mandrake is any different. I gestured with one open hand. But we're not operating in a context of general principles here, are we, Dang? I mean, you know that. Have you ever worked a response that rapid before? Ever had a set of instructions so total? How did it read? Find the originators of this signal and bring them back stack intact, all other costs and considerations subordinate, something like that. I let the question hang out in the air between us, a rope casually thrown out but aching to be grabbed. Go on. Grab. Only takes a monosyllable. But the silence held. The invitation to agree, to speak, to let go and answer, creaking under its own weight where I'd built it out into the air between us. He compressed his lips. Try it again. Something like that, Dang?
You'd better go ahead and kill me,
he said tautly. I let the smile come out slow. I'm not going to kill you, Dang. And waited. As if we had the mirror code scrambler. As if we couldn't be tracked. As if we had the time. Believe it. All the time in the universe.
You're...
He said finally. I'm not going to kill you, Dang. That's what I said. I'm not going to kill you. I shrugged. Far too easy. Be just like switching you off. You don't get to be a corporate hero that easy. I saw the puzzlement sliding into tension. Oh, and don't get any ideas about torture either. I don't have the stomach for that. I mean... Who knows what kind of resistance software they've downloaded into you? Too messy,
too inconclusive, too long, and I can get my answers somewhere else if I have to. Like I said, this is a one-time special offer. Answer the question.